The Delta Stewardship Council is called to order. Hey, sit down. Thank you. We're called to order, starting with Ms. Gray, who's standing over here on my left. Let's do the roll call. Ms. Gray's here. Mr. Fiorini?
Fiorini here.
Eisenberg here. Rumor has it that Mr. Johnston was seen with a cup of coffee across the street, headed on his way. He'll join us shortly. We'll operate as a subcommittee until the next member arrives. Ms. Gray.
Put it in here. Gray here. I just want to put it in my.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Chair's report. Oh, things are percolating along. Everybody in the water world is unbearably happy, joyful. What else can you say? Mr. Grindstaff, Executive Officer's report.
There are several things I wanted to mention today. We just completed on the last few days the fourth of four work sessions where we had a number of stakeholders coming and going through the Delta Plan, making suggestions and comments. And after that, it's turned out we're probably going to have to schedule another one on covered actions. That should happen probably mid to late October. I think just clarification, because people don't understand still clearly what's perfectly clear to me, and that's probably.
Or they do understand and they don't like it.
I think there's some legitimate lack of understanding.
Right. Okay.
So, and I think we have to at least clarify and make sure
And at some point during these two-day meetings, you're going to give us a fast summary, or somebody is, on the
we are going to have
sessions.
Both a written and a verbal summary of that.
And that'll be tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Okay.
And that's that was a good experience. I did want to mention that we've made some management changes that I just want to point out that we have assigned Keith Coolidge to do a lot more outreach. One of the things that we decided we haven't been doing a really good job of is actually communicating effectively with all of the various different parties out there. And Keith is really, really good at that and has great experience at that. So people that wonder about what's going on in the organization, one of the things we've done is actually given Keith more responsibility to deal with those issues and taken some of the administrative stuff and reshuffled stuff around. As you might imagine, internally within the administration, people are now beginning to talk about budgets, and I just wanted to mention that as they begin to prepare for the governor's budget this next year, there have been discussions. The Department of Finance hosted a meeting with us and Department of Water Resources just yesterday, and my expectation is over the next 1 to 2 months, there will be a lot going on behind the scenes as we try and figure out from the administration's perspective what they want to propose in the budget moving forward and how that supports the Delta Plan. So while we're working on the Delta Plan, there's this parallel effort that will be going on. Typically, the governor's budget is something that's developed behind closed doors so that when he releases it in January, it becomes a public document. I think that's probably the highlights for the last month. There have been lots of other things. I need to now turn to Chris and Kurt for the legislative
and
legal updates.
Who goes first?
Thanks. I think I'm going to go first and ask Curtis Keller to come forth. And you recall he's our legal extern from UC Davis, and he has to run to class here shortly. So he was kind enough to come and give a presentation on some of the
activities.
Didn't
Mr. Stevens agree to get a blanket exemption for you from attending classes?
Well, he promised to write me a note, but
I actually did. I said I'd write him a note, but I don't know how far that would go.
I don't think it flies very well in law school. So,
yes, sir.
So, pleasure to be here today. Like you said, Curtis Keller from UC Davis. So, two cases in case development that we'd like to update you on. The first, which undoubtedly you probably have caught some wind of, is the consolidated smelt cases. These cases have been viewed as indicators for the legal water wars in California, particularly the Delta. And so Judge Wanger from the Eastern District and the federal district courts has been the go-to guy in these sorts of cases for the past couple of years. And so a development in that case back in August, actually the end of August, August 31st, he issued a ruling granting an injunctive relief enjoining the Fall X2 action. And a little definition that the – we're talking about the X2 action, the Fall X2 action in this case, X2 referring to an area of salinity in the Delta, particularly 2 parts per thousand, speaking of using this as an indicator of where the smelt are either residing or using it as a basis for the health and viability of the smelt. And the Fall X2 action was a part of the biological opinion that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services distributed in 2008. That same biological opinion, which was remanded by Judge Wanger in 2010, however, was not vacated. And so as the Fish and Wildlife Services goes and revamps that biological opinion, some of the actions are still being implemented. So the federal defendants in this case sought to implement the Fall X2 action, which, in a wet year such as this, would be to control releases such that the X2 line would be placed and targeted at 74 kilometers east of the Golden Gate Bridge. The plaintiffs in this case, the state water contractors and DWR, they sought an injunction to enjoin that action based on irreparable harms to California state water users. In his decision, Judge Wanger particularly lambasted the federal science used to justify the Fall X2 action, stating that the federal scientists were unsupported in their determination that the X2 line was directly correlated with smelt viability. He also stated that the selection of 74 kilometers as a target for the X2 line had no biological basis. So particularly in the light that such an amount of water was going to be released and sent through the Delta, talking in terms of 300,000 to 670,000 acre feet. So given that there was little support and that they hadn't fully analyzed or at least assessed the impact to California water users, he enjoined the action and required that that the X2 line would not be set any further west than 79 kilometers. So it is interesting that he did couch his decision in terms of X2 because he did recognize that while there was not a direct no direct support for the marks with which the federal defendants were setting, that there was at least some correlation with setting the X2 line west of the confluence of the American and Sacramento rivers. And so in his decision, he did set it no further westward than 79 kilometers. The National Resource Defense Council did respond by filing an appeal to the Ninth Circuit. Both the NRDC and the federal defendants did motion to stay the injunction with Judge Wanger pending the outcome of the appeal or in the alternative to at least stay the injunction until October 15th due to a statement made by Judge Wanger as part of his ruling that there would be no harm realized to California water users until that time. Now, it's particularly because of the heavy rainfall, the abundance of snowpack and runoff, that due to preparations for flood protection, there are already releases keeping X2 further downstream than 79 kilometers. Now, interesting that in the hearing on the motion to stay, which was last Friday, Judge Wanger continued with his critical tone of the federal science that was used in this case, and in fact made a very clear statement of agency bad faith in this case, using language such that they not only didn't use the best science in this case, but they didn't use science at all, and that the federal science and scientists in this case were unworthy of the public trust. So he rejected the motion to stay. He did, however, lift the injunction until October 16th, citing again his ruling that there would be no immediate harm to the California water users. So just to point out, an obvious major theme of this case was the importance of not only science but good science, and that you don't want to be on the wrong end of Judge Wanger's stick when it comes down to
Judge Wanger's retiring in a month or something like that?
That's correct. That's correct.
So we'll find ourselves with a new judge to talk to.
That's correct. So that case, I know the NRDC has appealed it so far, and it's anticipated if it hasn't happened yet, the federal defendants will also be appealing that case to the Ninth Circuit.
Okay. And on the Salmon case?
Correct. And then just recently, I think on Tuesday, there was a rather large opinion issued by Judge Wanger, similarly rejecting the biological opinion for the second time in that case to do with the Chinook salmon and the protective measures being taken in that case. It's a rather lengthy discussion by Judge Wanger that we haven't fully digested yet, but in a similar vein, again, he makes mention of bad science and not being fully supported in their analysis. So that is, again, something that we'll look at as well, but along the same vein in those terms.
Okay. Are there questions? Yeah, Randy.
Not a question, but a compliment. You have a good grasp of the facts and an ability to explain them in understandable ways. Thank you.
I'll let my professors know. Thank you.
Okay. Let's note in the minutes, please, the presence of Mr. Johnston and Mr. Natoli. Quorum is established. Okay. Anything else on the legal side, Chris? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Grindstaff?
I think we'd like to have Kurt just do a brief update on the legislative side.
Okay. Mr. Miller.
If I knew who to give it to, I'd ask for a note, but I don't have a...
Oh, we'll give you a note, all right.
I'm sure you will. Good morning, council members. We met 2 weeks ago at this very same spot, well, within 6 miles of here anyway. Not much has changed since then. We met the day before the legislature adjourned, and on the 8th, they adjourned the 9th. The governor has until October 9th to deal with the 600 or so bills that are made it to his desk. Your packets include the up-to-date summary on the status of those bills that we've been tracking. None of the ones that made it to his desk have been dealt with yet, and they will start issuing daily updates on vetoes and signature on signings sometime soon.
And the action has to be concluded by the October 9th.
October 9th, yeah. That's this year's signature or dealing with deadline.
How many more bills outstanding to act on?
Well, the press accounts say 600, and he's signed a couple of them in the last few days, but mm-hmm. there's many, many more to go. They have lots of packets to deal with. Not much to add on budget, state budget. The cash flow figures came in for August since we last met. They were 100 and some million overestimates, which means our net underestimate count since July 1 is about $430 million or so. So they watch this monthly, the last cash flow numbers they'll use before they determine what to do at mid-year will be the November data for December unilateral action on the part of the Department of Finance under the provisions of the Budget Act that they passed in June.
Pat?
Is $600 million the tipping point?
This is for the triggered reductions?
Yes. Yep. And it kicks in. It's oddly written, but it results in a paper reduction of somewhere around $2 billion. And so they're anxious, to say the least. Next meeting will be October's meeting. We'll certainly have more timely information on these bills.
On Senator Wolk's Senate Bill 834,
mm-hmm.
The governor hasn't acted on that
yet. Not yet, no.
And Phil, you sent
I sent a letter out expressing my own personal opinion and indicated that we would bring that subject back to the council. I didn't see it on the agenda. And so let's do it for tomorrow, please, Mr. Grindstaff.
We'll just include a copy of the letter for tomorrow.
Yeah, we should talk about the letter and what the bill does and how it relates to the Delta plan. Basically, is consistent with what is included in the Delta plan in saying that it expands the language about what self-reliance, regional self-reliance should be. And so we'll talk. We'll have more, and we'll talk about that tomorrow.
Yeah, maybe whatever the best committee analysis is you could have available for the members, you know, the bill, and then any additional summary you might have that points to its consistency, okay. Or if there are any problems with where we're headed in the Delta plan.
Yeah, the bill basically complements our activities without any untoward results.
I don't doubt that. Let's put the packet together for tomorrow, please. Let's have all the information. Let's set it.
Right.
Mr. Grindstaff, pick a time for the presentation tomorrow.
I'd like to do it first thing in the morning.
Okay, and also we'll have public comment on the, before the council acts.
Okay, got it. Okay. Any other questions, comments?
Nope. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. You're welcome.
Mr. Grindstaff, you probably ought to tell us about schedule changes today. Mr. Machado was going to come, but now he can't.
Yes, we have noted on your revised agendas that we were planning to have Mike Machado come and talk about the economic sustainability plan today. He also has a Delta Protection Commission meeting today, and he had thought he would be able to do that, but upon further reflection and I guess talking with some of his commissioners, decided that he wouldn't be able to come today. He will be here tomorrow, so tomorrow morning we will take up first the legislative thing, SB 834, and then take up Mike Machado and have him talk with us about the economic sustainability plan and specifically about their recommendations for the Delta plan.
Don.
Mr. Chair, just to add, Mike spoke with me as chair, and I think in discussing it, the commission comes into session at 4 this afternoon, and we'll probably be in session for several hours this afternoon and this evening. And we will have a discussion about the sustainability plan, the most recent draft. And I think Mike was hopeful we'll get some additional direction out of the commission today for the presentation tomorrow. So that's the reason for the delay in presenting this morning versus tomorrow.
Okay. Yep. All right. Anything else, Mr. Grindstaff? No? Okay. So, members, let's go, please, to file item number 5, adoption of the minute summary from the August 26 meeting. File item number 5. Any questions? Any comments?
Move the item.
Mr. Natoli moves.
Second.
Mr. Fiorini seconds, starting with Mr. Johnston. Ms. Gray?
Gray, aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Eisenberg, aye.
Natoli, aye.
Okay, that's adopted. Thank you very much. Okay, item number 6, Ms. McPeak. Thank you for showing up early when we called you and said we'd had a hole occur in our schedule. You and Mr. Gardner were very willing to show up early. We appreciate that a great deal. Sonny McPeak is chair of the Dell Division Foundation, or president of the Dell Division Foundation.
Members of the Delta Stewardship Council. I am here with Charles Gardner, who is our executive director. We appreciate very much the invitation to come in and share with you the 2011 report card from the Delta Vision Foundation. What I want to do is give you just a little bit of background about the Delta Vision Foundation, the process and purpose of the report card, have Charles give you more of an in-depth explanation of the methodology behind the grades in the report card, and then I will summarize the recommendations that we have made. Let me begin in terms of the background of the Delta Vision Foundation by saying it's an interesting experience to be sitting here in this room and looking at all of you who have been generous in your time and commitment to serving the public, and we thank you for that. A few years ago, I was sitting there as a member of the Delta Vision Task Force, and those of us who were then on the task force thought, historically, there has been a pattern of California adopting plans and then getting distracted in one way or another and not implementing them. We thought it would be helpful in the public policy arena to have a citizen effort or group try to hold accountable the state of California for actually implementing the Delta Vision strategic plan. We were probably euphoric for a variety of reasons. We were at the end of our term and probably had shared a little bit too much wine and thought, we'll do this. And two foundations also thought it was an important investment in the public process. The Bechtel Foundation and the Packard Foundation have supported the Delta Vision Foundation. In envisioning the Delta Vision Foundation, I never thought I would be sitting here as its chair or president. There are former members of that task force who must be quite amused that circumstances have evolved, that I now have this responsibility, and I did just elicit the right smile from your chairman.
Serves you right, Ms. McPeak.
Yes, Mr. Eisenberg. So I want the record to note that we had envisioned other leadership for the Delta Vision Foundation. Having said that, when the Delta Stewardship Council was appointed and formed, we then had to regroup and took a while to actually establish our operations, to recruit staff. And a year ago in September, we had a roundtable in which we were very much benefited by having you, Mr. Eisenberg, you, Mr. Fiorini. We had also, we had an addition, Felicia, who's there for the whole time. But I know that, Pat, you joined us and other members to actually inform the report card process. What we were trying to do is obtain input, gather input in terms of what would be positive. I want to underscore that we view the responsibility from the foundations in doing an annual report card for it to be a positive force in the implementation of the Delta Vision Strategic Plan. We will not be successful if we simply issue a report card and we don't get to implementation, if that's not a useful dynamic of encouraging all the parties to be faithful to what had been recommended in the Delta Vision Foundation. It's not, as we view it, a gotcha process. In other words, it's not intended to be some report card that gets headlines in the media. Instead, we hope it will be a set of recommendations that actually cause either different action or improvement on actions to get to implementation. In that Delta Vision strategic plan, there were two co-equal goals. Those goals being restoration of the Delta estuary and water supply reliability. And bottom line is, all of our activity needs to be measured by, do those two goals get achieved? A plan is intended to get us there, and we're right now evaluating to what extent are the actions that you are engaged in and the other entities that have responsibility under the legislation that was subsequent to the Delta Vision Strategic Plan, how are those being implemented? But we're also evaluating is the estuary getting better, and do we have greater supply reliability? Bottom line, that's where we need to be. So you will see in this report card that in addition to assessing the progress in the process, in the inputs, if you will, we're also keeping our eye on the outcome, the delta restoration and supply reliability, and hope that we can focus everyone's attention on getting to those goals sooner rather than later, seeing progress towards those goals sooner than later. So it was in that spirit we also evaluated leadership of all of the agencies. Charles will give you really good insights to that. Let me also say that as much as I respected my colleagues on the Delta Task Force and those of us who were asked by the foundations to be the directors of the Delta Vision Foundation, I hope I don't labor under any misconception that we have a corner on insight or truth or intelligence, and so we intentionally try to make this an inclusive process. We have been fortunate to have three new directors join our board, and these are individuals who actually are pretty familiar with the Delta Vision process since they were part of the committee and the cabinet that oversaw the task force report that we issued. Former Secretary Mike Chrisman, former Secretary of Mike, of course, was Resources Secretary, former Secretary of Ag and Food, A.G. Kawamura, and former Secretary of Cal EPA, Linda Adams, have actually joined our board. That's very helpful in terms of the continuity that we need in order to be helpful and a positive contribution to the process. But we also, then, as Charles will describe to you, and you can see on the back of this report card, this is the executive summary. The full report card's online. Last year when we did the roundtable summary, that, too, has been circulated to everybody and posted online to be able to show what was the input to how should we do this report card. You can see that there were 35 interviews that were done by Charles, in-depth interviews, and then we went out to about 1,000 stakeholders and asked them to participate in an assessment online. Our intent is to continue that kind of gathering of input directly from those of you responsible for implementing the legislation pursuant to the Delta Vision Strategic Plan, and also to get assessment of the stakeholders. And we slice and dice it enough to be able to give you feedback as to what particular viewpoints are held by which part of the stakeholder community. So having said that, I'm known for being somewhat of a taskmaster. I will tell you that these grades are, we've gotten mixed grades on our grades. We've gotten mixed grades on our performance. We've had various stakeholders want to give us a report card, and we've welcomed that too. By and large, I will just confess that this does represent the consensus of the Delta Vision Board of Directors after getting all of this input from the stakeholders and from the interviews. We have been told we were too lenient. I actually think my colleagues were even harsher in their grades than I personally would have been, because we think the effort to date has actually been important to note. At the same time, keeping in mind the Delta and supply reliability are still at very extreme risk. And so it's been 3 years since I sat there and we issued the report. It's been 2 years since the legislation passed. If there's anything that should be the clarion call and that we will underscore in this report card, is that time is ticking away. And there has to be action as soon as possible. And I want to come back to that in talking about the recommendations. So let me turn to Charles to actually go over the grades or the substance of the report card, and then I'll conclude with the recommendations.
Mr. Gardner.
Thank you. As Sonny said, there were really three areas that we looked at. We looked first at the progress of actions. The Delta Vision Strategic Plan identified 85 actions, 75 mid- or long-term actions, and 10 near-term actions. So we looked at those, and the first step in that was trying to figure out, well, who's responsible for those actions? And that took a little bit of work. It's not entirely clear always who is responsible. But and then followed up with those agencies who appeared to be responsible to identify what is the status of those actions. It's a little easier to do with the specific actions that were identified in the Delta Vision Strategic Plan. It's a little more challenging with the long-term actions that set some direction. But we made an attempt to identify a scoring mechanism of progress of each of those actions and then consolidating them in five areas. The near-term actions, which the board thought was the most critical, and scoring the progress of those near-term actions. But then looking at the seven goals of the strategic plan and grouping those in four areas: governance, ecosystem restoration and recovery, delta vitality and security, and water supply reliability. And then within each of those, looking at the actions that primarily focused on those overall objectives. The board found that overall the near-term actions, the progress on those was extremely disappointing. Many of the near-term actions identified in the Delta Vision Strategic Plan were already conceived and in the planning stages, and so at this point we expected to see more actual implementation. Generally across the board in the near-term actions, there's been a lack of actual implementation. That category got a very low grade, got a D. Governance, obviously the legislature took action on many of the governance recommendations. You're all sitting where you are as a result of that. So overall, the governance actions got a higher grade. Of the five categories, those actions had moved forward the most. So those got a B+. Ecosystem restoration and recovery, delta vitality and security, water supply reliability. We acknowledge that there are many of the actions are in the planning stages, but there has been little implementation. And the focus of our evaluation of the actions progress is implementation. And so overall, we expect to see much more action and progress and implementation in those areas. As Sunny said, we've done a lot of planning in California. The implementing is the hard part. The two other areas we looked at were the leadership and effectiveness of organizations. As a critical part of making progress and implementing things, the organizations and how they're functioning is really important. And we looked primarily at the state agencies responsible for implementation, and within that group we looked at the 10 that have the majority of the responsibility for implementing the actions in the Delta Vision Strategic Plan. However, we also looked at the federal agencies as a group and their cooperation with the state as a critical element of implementation. And we also looked a little bit at stakeholder constructiveness and cooperation. That's an area that I'm personally interested in evolving how we evaluate that, because I think that's really critical. Is to be encouraging cooperation and contribution from stakeholders and not just the criticism that we often see of different elements. So overall, I think we were a little gentler on the organizations because there is a lot of effort going on. One of the most encouraging things is that we see across the board everyone is talking about the two co-equal goals. And that's a very positive thing, that in all of these organizations, it's part of the vernacular, it's part of the planning, it's part of the thinking. How do we adapt with this new thinking of co-equal goals? And that's a significant accomplishment in just a few years. However, we also tried to lay out some expectations of how we want to look at state agency performance, particularly in the future, and in some way put agencies on notice that people are watching their leadership effectiveness, their commitment of resources, their program management, their follow-through, their efforts to implement. So that was that category. And then the last, as Sunny mentioned, we wanted to focus on results. We recognize that you have some responsibility for developing performance measures, so we didn't want to duplicate that effort. It's a complicated thing to measure, you know, are we making progress on ecosystem and what are the metrics of that? So the way we looked at it was to look at the broader perspective of are we reducing the risk for the co-equal goals? Are we reducing the risk of economic losses because we're not providing a sufficiently reliable water supply? Are we reducing the risk of losing species because we're not managing the ecosystem effectively? And so in that sense, it correlates with a wildfire risk kind of chart. And at this stage, it's based largely on feedback and opinion from the people that we talk to, stakeholders and agency people. Our goal is to create a little bit more objectivity to it in the future. But overall, the finding is that we, in the last few years, we have not taken sufficient action to reduce the risks. As many people have acknowledged, we had a lot of water this year, and maybe that helped reduce some risks on water supply reliability or even ecosystem. But that's not a result of our actions. So if we look at the actions that we expect to see in implementing the Delta Vision Strategic Plan, we haven't seen the actions that really reduce the risks yet. So with that, I'll turn it back to Sunny for the recommendations.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Charles. Having established the framework for assessing progress this year, we thought it was also important to actually make recommendations. You will find in the full report card recommendations for each of the four grouped strategic actions and each agency. But then we rolled that up and said, overall, if we were to be asked to advise you and your colleagues and other agencies responsible for implementation, what are the highest priority recommendations that we think would improve the grades, if you will, next year? And so those are on the last two pages inside the back cover. And if you just want to turn to those, I want to briefly comment on each of them. We observe and we get feedback that the broad stakeholder community still has a great deal of support for the Delta Vision Strategic Plan. In part, it's always easier to get agreement at broader levels and drilling down to specifics. There is a lot more devil in detail. We know that, and that's your challenge. But we return to what was the heart or the essence of the Delta Vision Strategic Plan to make these assessments on grades and these recommendations. And we start with the fact that, and let me just repeat the first these five and then come back, that the first one is to intensify the focus and immediately implement the near-term actions. Immediately implement the near-term actions. Secondly, improve coordination among the agencies and the bodies. Third, link the strategies and actions for a workable solution. Link the strategies and actions for a workable solution. Four, optimize the value of independent science, how we use the science. And five, refine the funding and financing plan, which we know you are focusing on. So let me start with the near-term actions. I was reminded, as Mr. Grinstaff, you talked about the budget, that's being promulgated right now. Can't get to near-term actions without capital appropriation. And as we point out in recommendation number one, there is still quite a bit of general obligation bond authority from Proposition 1E for levies. There has been a rather modest commitment, to say the least, from the Department of Water Resources and the administration to date for what is a fairly broadly supported approach of immediately improving through Delta transfer and at the same time investing in a strategic levy system. Now, that is something that I realize you're addressing in the plan, but in the administration and with the legislature, there needs to be immediate action on that recommendation besides or in addition to the preparation for emergencies in the Delta? That's essentially what those near-term actions say. There are 10 of them. There's an opportunity now to weigh in legislatively, to comment on what should be in that budget, and particularly in the capital budget. Moving to the second item, in terms of coordination among the bodies that have responsibility. So the Delta Stewardship Council, the Delta Conservancy, the Delta Protection Commission, the Water Commission, the agencies that do the implementation besides do the policy or the planning. We observe that there is a lot of goodwill and a lot of sharing of information. What does not seem to be happening is a marshaling of everybody in the same direction and as if this is a Manhattan project-focused effort. I do not have the sense, personally, we don't as an agency or an organization, that there has been this intense focus brought by the administration with the commitment and oversight and urging of the legislature that this is the equivalent of we got to win a war here. This is a Manhattan project on that scale. Unfortunately, it is on a time frame that way exceeds what it took us to win World War II. I mean, I it's just astounding to me the time frames that we all tolerate and that we hope Providence and Mother Nature allows us the luxury of this time to actually get our act together. So having said that, we don't think you have the burden, the largest burden of the responsibility to coordinate everybody. That really does fall to the administration, and we have recommended that the most logical place for this to happen is the Natural Resources Agency. But somebody needs to do it or it ain't going to get done. And I've had the experience of working in a lot of bureaucracies, public and private, and state government, and I assure you that this recommendation is based on the only thing that's ever worked to pull off this kind of a project. Third recommendation, which is probably the hallmark of the Delta Vision Strategic Plan, is that the actions are linked. We put forth 7 recommendations, and if those are not implemented together and linked together, you're not going to get to the 2 co-equal goals. Simply it's not going to happen. And right now, the recommendations, the actions are pretty siloed. They're not linked. We focused on 3 things in terms of linkages to get those 2 co-equal goals, and they come down to what probably you're going to need to have in the plan and in that environmental impact report to bulletproof it. You know, it's important that that environmental document, the EIR and EIS, actually recognize the dynamic of an ecosystem. Say, it's not one species at a time and it is not one standard at a time. You have to actually assert that legally and make sure that that is the foundation for future challenges. And then secondly, that each of these actions are linked to each other. The importance of that is that you need to have the rebuttable defense when somebody tries to pick off any one piece of it that you have found, that you've asserted first in science, and that you have found and planned for each of those pieces to be part of the environmentally preferred alternative. If the document does not say that, you do not have as great a chance of defending it. And so that's an important piece of this linkage. The facilities that get built have to say they are to be operated consistent with the restoration of the environment. There has to be a condition on those facilities that anybody who benefits from them actually optimizes efficient water use. And if there is no linkage between storage and conveyance and today, there is no linkage being done on storage and conveyance. Here or at the Bay Delta Conservation Plan, if those are not linked, you still will not get to the 2 co-equal goals. There's no way to actually, and the vision strategic plan and what we still interpret and evaluate to achieve those 2 co-equal goals, if there's no capture of surplus water to be transferred. And the capacity does not exist today in the system. So those linkages are what we recommend and seriously say what, in all our sincerity, hope you will embrace in the Delta plan and that the other agencies will get into their documents. Fourthly, it sort of, maybe it sounds obvious, but there's a whole lot of scientific investigation going on, and what really is needed is agreement from the scientists on how to define the two co-equal goals and do what's the evidence, what will we take, have we succeeded? I mean, literally, we can spend a ton of money on a lot of science in an investigation, but if it doesn't deliver that in a short period of time, then we're not getting to what we need as value for the investment in the independent science. And lastly, we know that you are focusing on funding and financing. We have reviewed your draft Chapter 9. We will be making comments on it. We're going to, in October, have a roundtable discussion on it. I want to just briefly comment on what we said in the report card, and we'll elaborate on it now that we've had the chance to look at your draft. But there is a confusion between funding and financing. I mean, funding is the source of the money, and financing is the mechanism to incur debt. And those get confused. They get confused a lot because general obligation bonds obviously get serviced by the general fund. And there's not a reliance on or enough thought to the revenue bonding financing mechanism, which gets supported by revenues or fees in some way or another. In the funding and financing plan, that's where the legal linkages of actions have to be reinforced. So let me come back to that. That right now, there's nothing being discussed. It's not in the bond measure. Don't know what's going to happen with the bond measure that's up for vote next year. I think a lot of discussion, I hope, is going on behind the scenes because there's surely not sufficiently going on in the scenes, in the public arena. We hope that there can be more discussion about this and that we can put in context the importance of making this investment. Let me say, and I will speak personally, this is not the time to underinvest in the water infrastructure of California. I mean, that is sort of a red herring about we can't afford it. We can't afford not to invest. What we can afford to do is waste water or waste money. And now we've got to actually step up. I think there's a lot to be desired in what is that bond measure, and a lot that shouldn't probably be there, a lot that can be refined, and actually it's within the power of the administration to plan and program appropriate, responsible use of a bond measure, quite honestly. So that we will come back to you on the funding and financing. What we think is so important for you to have in that Delta plan is that the funding and financing mechanisms have to require the linkages of these actions in order to be able to get to achieving the two co-equal goals. I want to conclude by saying that I hope I live long enough to issue a report card that has all A's, because that's actually what the public deserves. It's what this document should help do, is get us all to achievement that deserves an A. And we want to be first appreciative of your service, and secondly, helpful and supportive of figuring out that pathway forward. So thank you for inviting our testimony and being interested in it, and we're here to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Pat.
Mr. Gardner, the methodology was to interview people interested in water in the state or involved in it. In your recommendation number two, did the interviews cause you to conclude, as you write here, there is an obvious tension between the process being led by the administration through the Natural Resources Agency and the Delta Stewardship Council process?
Yes. That was feedback from stakeholders and agencies, is the coordination and alignment of those two processes is really critical.
The recommendation seems to then conflate the BDCP process with the council Delta plan process and call for it being the one team, one solution, one approach, one administration effort. Is that what you're getting at?
I think, as Sonny said, there is an overall responsibility of the administration of the state to coordinate those two things and make sure that they're moving forward in an integrated way towards implementation. And so far that
well, the statute seems to give us duties and responsibilities, including a review of the BDCP, you know, plan when it's available, that make it impossible for us to be kind of all in the same locker room in John Laird's lair planning the future of water. Right?
I think that's true from your legal responsibilities in a review. I think in terms of planning and implementation at the administration level, there is more opportunity for coordination and clarity to the stakeholder community and the public of how these two things are going to work together.
So this is mostly a recommendation for the administration and what they do, and we're part of it, but with different responsibilities? Or
yes, there are at least 10 agencies, probably closer to 20 state agencies that have various responsibilities. And what we're recommending is more coordination of all of those functions.
You talk about the action team should have a process for input for all stakeholders, and then you catalog them. What's your observation about the stakeholder opportunities to comment and be heard by the council?
I think that's one of the areas where you got very high marks, is that your iterative process of the Delta plan and your responsiveness to the comments, that's a laudable process, and you get high marks for that. I think this recommendation on actions reporting is really focused on implementation and accountability for across all the state agencies for scheduling, programming, follow-through, implementation, and being clear and transparent with stakeholders and the public that we're on track. And I think you as a group get high marks in that arena. You've got a clear deadline, you're moving towards it, you're taking feedback, and I think doing a great job with that.
May I add something, Mr. Johnston, and compliment Charles on defending recommendations that came from people who had been longer involved in the process than he has, but you did an excellent job of defending him. I think you do get high marks, and to a large extent, it's because you're also being proactive. There's a difference between having a public process and noticing meetings and going out and actually inviting input. There has been a much different approach with Secretary Laird and Jerry Merrill in reaching out. They have also been proactive. There are still complaints about who's at the table, who's been in the room in the past as we've gotten this far with BDCP. It's important to continue to be as proactive in reaching out. This list does call out some, and it wasn't intended and says it's not limited to, but it includes people who feel like they weren't fully engaged when I was a member of the task force, even when we were trying to reach out. And I know that no matter what I've ever done in the past, it's never been enough. There always will be someone that will complain, but it's important that the majority feel very included, and I think we've already said congratulations to you in doing that. Part of the problem the stakeholders have is that they literally have to run around, I count them, to about 8 or 9 forums right now. And yes, there is legal separation of responsibilities spelled out, delineated in the law, with respect to the responsibility and role of the Delta Stewardship Council and what's going on over with BDCP. But if that train gets so far down the track, and you're sitting here trying to review it, there is a likelihood that there will be further conflict, as opposed to could you have had over with the focus on conveyance and integration in that process to the actions that you're discussing here that haven't been taken into account there. That's the major problem going on between BDCP and the plan.
Randy.
The role of the council has been defined as one of coordinating and synthesizing what is already in existence and moving on to actions that will result in achieving the co-equal goals. And the action team that you set forth in the second recommendation lines up really well with our understanding of what our role is. I hearken back to about 2003 or 4 when the Little Hoover Commission did a study of CalFed, and they were very critical about governance and the lack of support for that process from the highest levels. And they suggested that if the governor and the president of the United States would fully engage and hold their agencies accountable unto achieving action, that it was the Little Hoover Commission's view that things would happen. Now, I don't see that in the recommendations. It doesn't come through very loud and clear. It's my view that the President of the United States and the Governor of California often act very swiftly in the face of a crisis or a catastrophe and marshal all the efforts to meet the needs of the citizens and fix the problem. Well, we've got kind of an invisible crisis on our hands. And I don't sense the same thing that you've highlighted. I don't sense the sense of urgency coming from the highest levels of government. I think it's well and good that the council help form an action team and work on through this planning process and unto actions. But my question for you, how do we engage the President of the United States? How do we engage the Governor of the State of California to recognize that we have a crisis on our hands that would be devastating to the national and the state economy if the disasters that are predicted by many experts come to fruition before we employ many of the actions to prevent that?
Thank you for the question, Mr. Fiorini, and I totally agree with you. You were right, and I'm noting it, that we didn't actually explicitly say something as important as the Delta Estuary, a national natural asset, and supply reliability for the largest state economy in the nation deserves that attention. I personally say it. I wasn't here in August because I was giving a speech, and I said that in the speech, that this problem absolutely requires the leadership of the governor of the state of California and the president of the United States. So in response to how do we engage, one of the process questions that we at the Delta Vision Foundation had is, do we evaluate the federal agencies? And you can see we started through that process. Charles identified that as an issue, and there was discussion. He could elaborate on it, but it's and we intend to do more. We do think it's important that our congressional delegation be briefed on the process, and that's part of what we're doing, to elevate it, to ask our congressional delegation to take it to the federal administration. It will take Interior absolutely being directed and empowered as a full partner ultimately to solve these problems. Our federal and water molecules don't separate themselves out, and the Delta are at the pumps. And so those are, thank you for underscoring that. The Delta Vision strategic plan didn't have much focus on that, and that's in part our, if you will, our touchstone and why we are not in the business of promulgating new policy. We're interpreting the Delta Vision Foundation is funded to assess to what extent that strategic plan is actually being implemented, because that plan is looked to by the foundations that invest in the Delta Vision Foundation and the stakeholders as the best safe harbor for agreement and a workable solution with linked actions. But thank you for reminding us. The sense of urgency that we intend to underscore should absolutely imply and require the direct engagement of the governor and the president.
And I would add that in the specific recommendations related to the federal agencies, we did recommend that they establish and with the appropriate authority a point person to represent the federal government. They have a coordinator now, but without that clear authority to represent the federal government, which, as I understand it, they considered and did not do when they appointed their coordinator.
And might I add, the federal agencies individually and the people serving actually want to do that. And I also will say that's the sense I have of every one of the state agencies and individuals. There is not a lack of interest or willingness by the agencies or the leadership of these agencies, the public employees who've been there for a long time. They want to be a part of a success. It comes down to, now I'm looking at Joe again, the nature of leadership and who is empowering people to do something beyond what might be the interpreted letter of the law or what people hope for, the legislature or a governor who signed a piece of legislation, for them to come together and to act in concert. And so then I guess that underscores what you said, Randy, the governor and the president have to say, go do it.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming. And thank you for coming early. Appreciate it a great deal. Okay, Mr. Grindstaff, we have 57 minutes of lag time because of some schedule changes. We were going to move some people up from tomorrow into this block of time. How do you want to start?
Well, I don't see Gary as Gary Darling. Oh, there you are. Right in front of me, Gary.
Okay.
So I think we can just follow the agenda.
Okay, we're going to move to advance to file item number 7. File item number 7, Mr. Darling's here. Mr. Darling, let us give us 30 seconds to get the screen material up there on your presentation. Okay. Mr. Darling.
Thank you, Chair Eisenberg and members of the Council. Today I would like to present an idea that we think has a lot of potential in terms of the planning process, both on a near-term basis as well as for consideration on a larger scale.
Yeah. Members, in your material on your desk this morning was a copy of, I believe, the slideshow you're going to zip through during the presentation.
That's correct.
So you have a hard copy of it.
Right. So the second slide, just as a little background, who is Delta Diablo Sanitation District? My district is a medium-sized agency that serves 200,000 people in the Pittsburgh, Antioch, and Bay Point area in eastern Contra Costa County, located on the western Delta. We are one of the largest industrial recycled water plants in the state of California. We are award-winning in our size class of no discharge violations over the last 9 years, which we're very proud of. Our board of directors are the mayors, the mayor of Antioch, the mayor or their appointee of Pittsburgh, and for Bay Point, the board of supervisor for Contra Costa County. So we have Mayor Davis, Nancy Parent, and Supervisor Federal Glover. Their interest in all of this, and you'll see this on our strategic plan, online is that we are very involved in regional solutions on several fronts and new jobs. Jobs are a big theme that you'll see in my presentation today. A little bit about me. Some of you know I've worked with some of you in the past. I do have quite a background in water resources development. I was the program manager for the first Los Vaqueros project all the way through to filling. Then moved over to East Bay Mud, and I was the program manager for the Freeport project during the environmental review phase. And Mr. Natoli will recall my involvement in the setting up the Joint Powers Authority between East Bay Mud and Sacramento County, which was very successful. But just as that background, that I'm aware of what it takes to locate diversion points in the Delta, what avoidance means, in terms of working around special status species. Is extremely important in this conversation. Also been involved more lately on a lot of regional recycled water projects. We have a coalition of 14 agencies in the Bay Area that have developed over the last 3 years 20,000 acre-feet of new water for the Bay Area recycled water, and we have another set of 14 that we have in front of Congress to develop the next 30,000 acre-feet of water for the San Francisco Bay region, which has a very direct delta benefit in terms of that recycled water development. Up on the left-hand corner, I'll touch this a little bit more. The Diablo Innovation Alliance is something I've been very involved in the last year, and it's with the Contra Costa Council, and we're working on a workforce development concept of bringing new jobs to our region, specifically focused on innovative water solutions and renewable energy. So in the last 3 years, we've presented three different letters to the process through BDCP and as well as your Delta planning process. The basic message is this, and that the planning should include a study of the Western Delta area. And I'll get into some of the reasons of that. But there is the possibility of a small near-term project that could be used as an emergency supply. Because of the fact there's treatment involved in this concept, it offers a very high-quality water supply, and the potential, all of this is premised on the fact that we believe that it's fish-friendly, that it avoids the impacts to the protected species, could actually produce new yield or supplemental supply. The larger alternative that we also have in our letters could look at either in combination with other alternatives from the Northern Delta, but certainly the distance between the Antioch-Pittsburgh East County area to Clifton Court is quite a bit shorter for a conveyance facility. The idea would be to offer operational flexibility, the concept being that water has flown through the Delta at that point in time where you pick it up. So at times where fisheries impacts are an obstruction to running the pumps in the South Delta, this offers the flexibility of actually firing up pumps in the western part of the Delta. And again, the idea that this could be potentially new yield. So the idea is very scalable in terms of treatment. As you well know, you can start out very small and add lots of units all the way up. You know, we studied up to the point of 1 million acre feet, and that's certainly out of the box idea. So that would seem as how there's nothing that large in the world, but there are a lot of smaller components and different parts of the world of the Middle East, Australia, and we are playing with the idea here in California and the United States, but it really is something that is it's very doable. It's been proven. There's a lot of improvements that are happening related to treatment, and I'll get into a little bit of that in a second. But back to jobs. This is a very interesting to our board. You look at the idea of something that is a diversion point and treatment, and the depending on the size, it could create considerable number of jobs and, on an operating basis, sustainable jobs for our region. And this is the Diablo Innovation Alliance. One of the things that we've done is we've looked at what are the assets in our region. And this slide represents all those little blue water faucets. There's a lot of water technology startup companies related to treatment, conservation, just a lot of water companies in our region. Additionally, in this region of Alameda, Contra Costa, and Solano County, we have some of the most prestigious universities available with Davis and Berkeley and Stanford, as well as the labs, the regional labs of Lawrence Livermore Lab, Sandia, and others that have focused at some point in time on water development for different reasons, but haven't focused really on the type of thing that we're talking about now. And our leaders in Contra Costa County, the Contra Costa Council, are very much behind this idea of where are the new jobs in innovative water solutions, renewable energy projects and technology. So the three common questions that we've gotten related to Western Delta diversion is, well, what about the impacts to Delta and Longfin smelt as well as other protected species? Isn't the Western Delta too salty? Is it too costly? There's, you know, greenhouse gas impacts with this kind of treatment that we're talking about. It's costly. And how about the other water rights in that area? What would be the impacts to agricultural, other municipal intakes and such? So we've completed three studies that are available online that indicate that have touched on each of these points, and I'll just give you an overview briefly of some of those conclusions. So the fact that the Western Delta is not the bay, it's not the ocean, the amount of salt in it is one-third on a regular basis of what the ocean and the bay are. So that just translates directly to a third of the cost. So that's fairly straightforward. The cost to desalinate water is decreasing over the last 10 years. A couple of highlights that I put on this slide just announced less than 3 months ago in Singapore, Siemens announced a new technology that reduces the desalting energy by over 50%. So there's a lot of development happening in that area. Australia just set up a research facility that opened just this month that's focused exactly on improving technology for advanced treatment. So some of our study results indicate that by setting up a diversion and treatment point in this Western Delta, the reliability aspect is high during a drought because you can treat for salt. So the delta goes salty during a drought. The delta is going salty because of sea level rise, and so this has a very high level of reliability related to sea level rise. Certainly, in terms of a delta levee failure, the reliability is extremely high because you cannot divert salty water to Southern California for human consumption or for agricultural uses. So the idea of being able to treat it seems very strategic. But most importantly, and I'll just go back on that slide right there, is the fish aspect. What our studies have shown is that you know, the Pittsburgh-Antioch area is in that X2 zone at half of the time. So half the time it's to the east, half the time it's to the west. So when X2 shifts to the east, to the central part of the delta, that's where the fish also go. So the idea is that you harvest water behind that. And, yes, it's more expensive to treat it, but it is a doable, and that's a key aspect of this concept, is this a fish-friendly possibility. So the Western Delta, in this slide represents or shows the about 20 miles of shoreline that I'm talking about between the Senator Nedjed Lee Bridge, or otherwise known as the Antioch Bridge, on the east side to all the way to the west to Chips Island. And, again, this is where the X2 area is. There's a lot of industrial zoned land that could be available for a major or a minor project facility. The other thing that is very interesting in this area is that 40% of California drains through this area. And the depth of the channels in this area about 40 feet deep. So it's a little bit of an Easter egg hunt, and as you know, in terms of trying to find a fish-friendly solution in the Delta, where can you go that you can work around tidal influence, water velocity, so the idea that you've got depth to play with, you've got temperature zones, you've got a lot of possibilities here that while in the past this idea may have surfaced and been dismissed, I think there is a project here. And that's what our initial studies have shown, and that's why we're suggesting it to be included into your planning process. But this slide represents, you know, we are an industrial area. Our cities very much encourage industry to come here. We've got 9 major power plants, so there isn't, you know, there's infrastructure already available there for this type of a concept. So we believe to be a win-win in terms of fisheries issues from the concept of adaptability, operational flexibility to avoid fish impacts. We see it as highly reliable, whether it's a levee failure, a dry period, or a sea level rise. This could be viewed as either replacement yield for the state and federal projects or a new yield, potentially. And a lot of the alternatives that are being considered out there don't produce new yield. This, though, could if it proved out to be fish friendly. Water quality standpoint, it's a win-win. You could, by adding treatment, you get rid of the salts. Other constituents of concern that we all are aware of, nutrients, pesticides, pharmaceuticals, all of that can be treated depending on, it's just a matter of cost. And the idea of salt from an agricultural standpoint, there's a huge issue related to recirculation in the South Delta for the Central Valley farmers. The idea if you take the salt out to begin with, maybe you have less of a problem. And that's a huge investment consideration in terms of the water that's flowing south is what do you do with those salts? And so this would be a potential solution that would address that. Brine disposal is another thing that comes up on a regular basis. And the area, again, I mentioned this is X2 at 50%, so the salts are quite a bit less than the bay or the ocean. If you take that and traditionally on a desalting concept, you double the salt concentration. And the idea would be that you would ship that to the west towards the bay and match the salt content of the bay. So you're not adding mass in this situation. You're not adding salt. You're simply concentrating. So the strategy would be to figure out a way to disperse that at a point where the mass is or the concentration is the same as the concentration that you're developing. That's the idea. Finally, the bigger alternative, again, if it were placed in the, for example, in the BDCP, a larger concept, there's a far shorter conveyance available. Upland soils is important that you look at the sea level rise modeling, and even at the 1 meter point, and I didn't bring that slide here, but the conveyance facility that from this area would stay out of that. So you're upland of what's going to happen in the bay or in the delta. Also, the upland soils are far more stable and easier to work in than the peat soils within the delta. Again, the intake in this area is much deeper with far stronger flows than any other part of the delta. So from a fish avoidance standpoint, screening, the velocities that you can work around the depth, it seems very intriguing. And that is the challenge, though. Is it fish-friendly with acceptable costs? Is it an emergency relief measure only, or is it an independent alternative? Those are the big questions. And so our recommended next steps include for the council to dedicate funds to the science program and let them get after this and look at it from an independent standpoint. And the devil is in the detail. It's not just one data point or a few in this area. Because of the depth of the water, the available, 20 miles of coast shoreline, the flows, there's a need to really get in and look at the details of this and find a project. Our initial studies indicate there is a project. But we offer all of that to the council and to the science program as a starter point. But I believe that that's very important is to get this in the hands of the science program. Secondly, included, in the emergency response planning, list a project in the council's near-term actions and funding plan. This is something that can be done right away. There are existing intakes out there that you could use to prove this concept. Is it fish-friendly? Is it cost-effective? Fourth, to include the Delta Plan in the Delta Plan as an adaptive management project, and fifth, to submit it to the BDCP as an alternative conveyance. That concludes my presentation.
Mr. Mitchell.
Yeah. Thanks, Gary, for your presentation. A couple questions. What's the general length of the conveyance? That you get that 20-mile range in there, but from either the furthest point or closest point to the Clifton Quarter, what's the, again, you showed the red line on that one slide. Get some sense of the scale there.
Okay, that's about 25, 30 miles.
Is it? Okay. Yep.
And our Los Vaqueros pipeline was 20 miles from Old River to right in the same vicinity that we're talking about. So I'd say about probably 30 miles, 25, 30 miles.
And what's the general elevation differential, say, from the shoreline there that you showed in the one slide to the Clifton Court? You obviously go over some topography, but what's the general elevation rise?
Well, again, this is the incised area. This is the channel of 40% drainage of California, so that gets upland fairly rapidly. My whole service area is up an elevation of 10 feet plus.
Okay.
So that's another advantage of when you look at sea level rise, you know, the fact that we've had 7 inches in the last 100 years and predicted lots more in the next 100 years, one concept of this being attractive is there's a fair amount of upland area available.
I'm curious, on the last bullet of your on the recommended next steps, what's been the reception you received thus far in the BDCP process? Obviously, they've gone through, you know, scoping of different sorts and, you know, whittled down to some, you know, a range of